Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Welcome to a special Tuesday afternoon edition of Nightlight. A lot of Nightlight shows delve into recreating ancient times with researchers who have very plausible theories, but yeah, they're dealing with just a few artifacts and no video. We've gone way back to the Denisovan peoples, 100,000 years ago, Atlantis. Today's show is more focused on a time when, a lot of us were just in elementary school, but we have a person who helped to create punk rock and was a witness to the punk scene on both sides of the Atlantic. Gary Lockman has been a guest with Barbara discussing his books on esoteric philosophies, but in another time, he was a founding member of Blondie and inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 2006. He went by the name of Gary Valentine then and has a fantastic autobiography of his time with Blondie and the punk scene. And, he worked with Iggy Pop and so many other, big name people. His autobiography is entitled New York Rocker, and it's available on Amazon. Hi, Gary. How are you?
I'm fine, Mark. How are you doing? Thank you again for wanting to go over these old times.
I first produced the show, when you were Barbara's guest the first time in, what was it, like May or something, and I wanted to have you on, just talk about, recreating CBGB. Mm-hmm. And, you said, I have an autobiography on it. And, so I went out and got the book and, finally have a chance to recreate your youth. This is going to be a lot of fun.
Well, that's a bad sign for people my age, and they start doing that. This is a sign that they're heading towards senility and things like that. So, I want everyone to know this is an exception this evening.
Right. Well, thank you for this opportunity. want to start off with, a little story about, why this show has like a personal connection for me. Probably September of 2012, saw on the Palace Theater websites that Blondie is going to be playing there in October. So you know, I asked my wife, let's go see Blondie for your birthday. So you know, I got the tickets. I thought, let me type up this little letter of introduction and in case we actually get to meet Debbie, see if she'd want to be a guest on show I was doing then. Got up there in the middle of the afternoon and thought we'd see if the tour bus pulls up or something like that. So, but by the time we got there, the tour bus was already parked, and my wife and I were just hanging out with like 8-10 other people, and I was there for about 30 minutes, and all of a sudden Clem comes around the front of the bus, and says hi to everyone. Signed a well-worn album, and takes off for a jog around town. About 15 minutes later, suddenly emerges, and everyone gathers around her, and she autographs all these albums, and when it got to my turn, I gave her the paper that I had typed up, invite her to an interview, and she said, what do you want to talk about? So, your new CD, your legacy, what's next for Blondie, and your appearance on the Muppet Show. And she burst out laughing about that, and she said, let's do all the photos, and she took was kind enough to spend a lot of time making sure everyone got the photos, and she had to head into the dressing room, and when she was walking away, everyone's like, "Oh, we love you, Debbie!" And I yelled, "Long live the new flesh!" And she turned around and gave me this smile, and she went into the venue. And a couple hours later, she started a fantastic show. So that's my little story of having met two of your bandmates, and now you're a guest on our show again for the third time, and it's kind of feel like a Blondie insider. since I care about history and want to have some kicks and want to get some chicks, let's get into the Nightlight Time Machine designed by Ed Wood and go back to that late 73, early 74 time period. Okay, so Woodstock is about 5 years ago. Okay, we have about another 3 or 4 years before the Sex Pistols and disco and new wave. Yeah. You're in just starting college, so you're in this transitional state. The music in a transitional state too. Let's recreate the scene that you find yourself in at that time.
I was living in New Jersey, Bayonne, New Jersey, which is the other side of the Hudson. from downtown New York, Manhattan. Put it this way, when I was growing up, I could see them building it's around this time. I could see them building the World Trade Center. So already it's not even going up by this, that's around the same time. And musically, I was getting introduced at the time to people like Bowie and Iggy and Lou Reed, and also from England, Mott the Hoople, was a band that I really got into. Ian Hunter, I liked a great deal. Actually, mm-hmm. got to meet him.
Yeah, we'll talk
on.
About that.
And I got to meet all these guys. I mean, you know, that's what I said. I had nothing to complain about. But everyone else was very angry. In the Blank Generation and all that, they were all very, very angry people. But I and the New York Dolls. And the New York Dolls were in many ways the most influential on me personally, in the sense that, I could go just over the in a river on the PATH train, which is at the New Jersey kind of underground transit that took you under the Hudson over to New York, and then could go see them play, and which I did. And also that what they played was very simple. It was three chords. You know, it was, when you look back at that time. And it was, I always think it's a very strange thing, because rock was already going through a nostalgic period itself. Because in the early 70s, you had this kind of back to the roots sort of sensibility. And mm-hmm. there were bands like Sha Na Na were doing all the doo-wop covers. And people like Chuck Berry and Jerry Lee Lewis and Little Richard were coming out and having kind of, second careers again in this period. And, you know, even big stars like John Lennon was kind of doing songs that were like, you know, going back to the roots and all this kind of thing. So what was happening in New York, I would say, I mean, from what I, you know, what I was coming to understand, because there were people that I knew in my hometown that were kind of on this edge. They were the fringe people, you know, because everybody else was sort of into, you know, mainstream rock or Grateful Dead and all this kind of thing. And it was kind of early 70s and getting on to the mid 70s, but it was sort of that late 60s sensibility and, you know, that kind of thing, Pink Floyd and all that. And this was before anything was happening in England. And so I started getting into this whole, what was known as glam rock here in the UK, but it was called glitter in the States. And, you know, it had its kind of hypertrophied, exaggerated expression in Kiss, you know? But I mean, they kind of took it, made it Hollywood, but the Dolls, they were playing this really simple three chord rock that was sounded like early Rolling Stones. And the thing is that when I went to see them play, they were playing in what was a drag club most of the time in New York, in the East Village, a place called Club 82 on 4th Street, 2nd Avenue. And there used to be a place called the Mercer Arts Center, which was just before my time. This place literally collapsed. It fell to pieces. And so they couldn't play there anymore. And they were all these bands that were sort of this underground New York scene at the time were looking for a place to play. And somehow they managed to talk the people who ran this drag club, Club 82, into letting them play. And so people started going there. And when myself and these other people I knew in New Jersey, the weirdos, you know, the fringe characters, heard about this, we went over and we started wearing makeup and all that kind of thing and hanging out at Club 82, and we saw the Dolls. I mean, the first time I saw Debbie Harry was when in her band, the Stilettos, and they were opening for somebody. May have been Wayne County, I can't remember now exactly, at Club 82. But also Bowie and Lou Reed were hanging out there. That was what we read about in the magazines. I think it was Rock Scene magazine or something like that. So we decided to go and hang out there, and so we did. And you know, we were walking on the wild side and everything else, and it was this wild time. And it was a very wild time for myself personally, because I was, you know, I got thrown out of my home. I wound up living in a variety of different sort of crash pads under less than salubrious conditions, but going through the kind of season of hell that apparently you're supposed to go through if you want to be a poet and all that kind of thing, which is what I wanted to do at the time first. And then, you know, out of that scene, the next thing started happening, you know, because the glitter kind of died down after a certain point. It didn't, I mean, I guess the big people made the big kind of success with it was Bowie, you know, with Ziggy Stardust and a variety of things. And then he changed direction at a certain point. And I was living in New York at the time. I was living in the East Village on 10th Street between First Avenue and Avenue A. And I was starving, as one has to be if you want to go through your poetic season of hell. And I was working as a messenger and reading a lot of Henry Miller and lots of other stuff. And standing in front of the Strand bookshop and deciding which you know, avant-garde paperback I could get for my quarter. And things like that. And Clem Burke, who I knew from Bayonne, who was we went to high school together, and he was playing. He played in all these bands in Bayonne, all these cover bands, you know, that did a variety of things. And you know, first off, it's like he's covering Santana and the Allman Brothers, and you know, people like that. And then when Glitter came, he got into another band, and they started doing sort of Bowie-esque kinds of things, and they were doing original songs too, and that was interesting. And he answered an ad in the Village Voice for a band in New York that was looking for a drummer. And this was Debbie, Harry, and Chris Stein, because their drummer had left for I forget exactly why. And so Clem started playing there, and I started going to their gigs. And long story short, they lost their bass player because well this is the narrative is there's another band, one of the big bands that were pioneering, the pioneer bands. I mean, Patti Smith was sort of one of the pioneer sort of this, you know, revived New York scene. And then the Television, Tom Verlaine's band, they were the other band. And the bass player in Television is Richard Hell, and he's pretty much the guy who invented punk rock, or he pretty much wore the first torn t-shirt. Put it that way. This is before safety pins. But he had the first torn t-shirt. And he left Television because he wanted to start his own band. And so Tom Verlaine nabbed Fred Smith, who was playing bass in Blondie. And Patti Smith, she was sort of in and out of Grease in the background, all this kind of rivalry between Chris and, between Debbie and Patti. That's kind of backstory and those kind of thing. But she basically told Fred Smith to leave Blondie to join Television because Blondie isn't going anywhere. And sort of ironic in the long run. And so Fred left to join Blondie, and Clem knew that I could kind of sort of almost maybe play. It was like I had played in like real garage bands, as they call them here, you know, bands where you played in the weekend and you drove your parents crazy because you had your friends over and they were playing, you know, covering, you know, simple rock tunes in the garage, you know. But I wasn't really a musician. I mean, this is the thing. This is one of the ironies in my own life is I'm in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. I've got gold records, hit records. I play with lots of people and I'm doing this show, but I was the last person one would have expected at this time to have been doing this because I really couldn't play anything. You know, I was the kind of nerdy guy who knew the lyrics, the kind of poet guy, you know, and so in any case, I was, you know, I had gone to all these gigs. I was living in this place on the low, as I said, in the East Village, and it was literally a storefront that, you know, someone has shoved a sofa bed into and, you know, a couple other things and turned it now into flat. And one of the things that was shoved in there was this old piano, and you know, every other key was broken, but I'd learned how to bang out chords. I learned how to bang out a few chords on the guitar. I learned how to bang out a few chords on the piano, and I just started writing songs. And so this very bad poetry I was writing got transformed into, you know, increasingly slightly better songs. And Clem said, why don't you come in audition? There's a whole other story. The guy I was living in, and I can't even go into that story, but the guy I was living with in this place, he was sort of the William Burroughs of where I grew up in New Jersey. And he later became a born again Christian. They went through this strange kind of transformation. So I was going through all that, you know, at this time. And but Clem said, why don't, you know, come and audition. I don't have a bass guitar. I said, don't worry, we'll borrow one or something. So I went and I was able to thump out, you know, we jammed on a Stone song, Live With Me, which I think is on Beggar's Banquet. You know, we jammed on that for about an hour or something. And then it's like, okay, it worked. And so I wound up playing with them. And then soon after that, after doing a few gigs with them and coming, because I had to leave the place I was living in New York because this guy, as I said, he was born again Christian, and he joined this cult, and he was going off to Israel to live in a kibbutz, and because the end of the world was coming and all this weird stuff, and he invited me to join him, but I declined. I didn't know where to live, so I had to go back home. And then for the first few months when I was playing in Blondie, I was still living back at home with my parents, and that didn't work out. And so the ultimatum was, you know, either you know, stop coming in at 4 a.m. or, go on, leave. So I left. And this is when I wound up for a while, I was homeless. I was sleeping in rehearsal spaces and sort of, what do they call, couch, I forget what it's called. Any case, I wound up living with Chris and Debbie. And Debbie had this small one bedroom in Little Italy. And Chris had his own flat over in the sort of Lower East Side, but he was subletting that to one of the Ramones.
Okay, and Gary, since you just got us to, you're part of the
That's
band.
About spring 1975.
Yeah. You didn't have any place to go, so Chris and Debbie had you.
Couch surfing. That's what I was saying. Couch surfing. Sorry.
Okay. And. Yeah, I have an interesting passage in your book, but we often talked about what was magic. Like Chris Benton was into the occult, and he was more serious about it. Chris was certainly a sucker for anything to do with vampires, voodoo, ghosts, and witches. He used to go on about spirits and poltergeists inhabiting the loft. Debbie agreed and would chip in about UFOs, telling me in all seriousness that she was an alien. She and Chris would sometimes consult the I Ching together, but it always seemed to me that they would do the opposite of what it advised. this is some really interesting behind-the-scenes look at what's going on inside this tiny apartment.
Mm. Oh, well, that was a different place. I mean, we – I was living with them on Thompson Street, and something like at a Goodfellas or that neighborhood, like, or the Godfather. So it's that kind of thing. And then that was a really small place. And a couple months or something, we moved into this loft space on the Bowery, which was just a block or so away from CBGB. CBGB, for people who don't know, is this legendary, really, really hole-in-the-wall dive bar on the Bowery in Bleecker Street that just happened to be the place where, after the kind of change in music, actually it's the place where the change in music started happening, where bands like Patti Smith and Television, they weren't doing it at Club 82 anymore. The glitter scene had dropped away. This is late 74, sort of like that. And they started playing at this place. And CBGB means country, bluegrass, and blues. And that was originally the Hilly Crystal, the owner's idea for the place. And it was a big biker bar. And the Hells Angels lived, not too far away. There was a whole Hells Angels block, which I think was East 3rd Street. Long story short, the New York scene, that was the place where it was started in CBGB. And we lived on the Bowery, 266 Bowery, if you're ever in New York. I was there not too long ago. And the whole area of the Bowery has completely changed. It's unrecognizable. I mean, and CBGB isn't there. It's some clothes shop where nobody who ever played at CBGB's could afford any any article of clothing that's sold in that place. So it's a complete, you know, it should be on, you know, Rodeo Drive in Beverly Hills or something like that. But in any case, except for the place where we lived, because where we lived, it looks, the outside of it looks exactly the same. I'm sure the inside's probably renovated. So I was really surprised by that. And actually, I liked that idea because it seemed like at least this remained. I mean, but in any case, so we lived a block or so. And, you know, everybody lived in that neighborhood. Everyone was around. Everyone was relatively within a stone's throw of each other, as it were. And William Burroughs lived just up the road from us on the Bowery. The Ramones had a loft. It's called, I think, Joey Ramone Place now, where their loft was. Just, again, the other side of CBGB, you know, a block or so away. And, you know, other people lived in other places not too far away. The Talking Heads had a place down on Delancey Street. But we moved into this loft space. And it was big, you know, it was really big, you know, by New York standards. And so Chris, Debbie, and I started living there. And the guy who lived there, this guy Benton Quinn, a very interesting guy. He was an artist of sorts, strange, histrionic, you know, kind of theatrical character, wild kind of gay guy, into the Hells Angels, into lots of strange stuff and magic and Aleister Crowley. And that's how I got interested in Aleister Crowley, and that's how I got interested in the kind of stuff I spent the rest of my life investigating and now I've been writing about for quite some time. And he was really into Crowley, and he used to do these – he had a Crowley cloth deck of tarot, and that was rare at the time. And he used to do impromptu readings, and he painted these big kind of canvases and based on the tarot deck and all this kind of thing. And, you know, and in this loft space, we collected all this weird stuff. You know, we there was like a statue of a nun. And someone had found these Tibetan tankas, you know, these tantric paintings or scrolls, and they were up on the walls. And one of them depicted a monk who had died. He was all chopped up in this tub. And, you know, the others were boiling him away, and they were going to eat him and all this kind of thing. And it was just, you know, weird stuff. And there was pentagram, you know, upside down crosses and viewed. And so it was kind of all kitschy, but at the same time, you know, kind of strange things happened. I mean, I have to say, you know, Chris Stein saved my life there once because I was electrocuted. I mean, I picked up a lamp in my little section of the rehearsal space that was my bit, and it must have had a short, and I just got, you know, however many volts running through me, and I was paralyzed. I couldn't let go of it. I couldn't say anything. I was just kind of squeaking, and no one was around me. And then he came. It was a big loft space, so he came from the farthest, you know, back bit where he was in, that was there, he and Debbie's room. He just came in to where I was, and you know, totally the other side of the floor, and he saw what was happening and just casually went over and unplugged the lamp. You know, if no one else had been there, who knows? So it was that kind of place. And so there were kind of strange things happening. There was all, Debbie and Chris talked about, you know, that some gangster had lived there in the past, and that there was it had been some kind of doll factory or some I don't know. There was all these strange. I can't remember all of them. It's all in the book, New York Rocker: My Life in the Blank Generation. But it was one of the places where the scene was happening too, because we had this fantastic party in early '76 when after Clem had been in England for a while, and he brought back albums. And one of the big bands that, you know, doesn't get mentioned that was influential on the New York scene was Dr. Feelgood. It was a British band. Again, this is the pre-punk thing. And Dr. Feelgood was this sort of pub band. Wilco Johnson was this great, you know, kind of just, you know, great guitarist and all that. And again, it wasn't yet called punk or anything, but Dr. Feelgood, they were kind of stripped down, straightforward kind of rhythm and blues, you know, pub rock band. And so, yeah, we had this great party when Clem came back, and he played all the stuff he brought back from England, and that was kind of like a pivot point when, after that, we emerged as this new Blondie. This, we had acquired Jimmy Destri. Uh-huh. I mean, that you know, Destri, that wasn't his, you know, his given name, and he adopted that name too because of the film Destri Rides Again. So that's when we kind of back, because Blondie in the early days, we were the worst band. Nobody ever expected us to ever become successful in any way whatsoever. You know, literally. I mean, I was, you know, everyone was kind of learning how to play except for Clem. He he already knew how to play, but everybody else was learning how to play on stage. And that was kind of the ethos of that scene. It was the total opposite of what was happening in mainstream rock, because it either, you know, it was so, you know, it was Las Vegas. It was so, you know, slicked down, or it was like Yes or Emerson, Lake and Palmer on this sort of, you know, Wagnerian operatic, you know, scale. And you had to go to the Juilliard School of Music in order to play rock and roll. So it was, again, it was complete opposite of that. And a weird mixture of the art scene and the poetry scene with, you know, Patti Smith and Verlaine and Hell, they wrote poetry and the lyrics mattered, you know, and there was short songs and nobody, aside from Verlaine, who was the television, they actually were a guitar band in the sense of he and Richard Lloyd, who were fantastic guitarists, and they're very different in styles, but they did play this, you know, remarkable kind of, almost like Grateful Dead sort of thing. It just, you know, long solos. But all the other bands weren't like that. It was short, sharp, you know, bang. And I mean, the Ramones were notorious. They had songs that were, some of the songs were, I think, were less than a minute.
Yeah. You know, Gary, you know, you just mentioned, you know, what the CBGB, you know, building is now, but, you know, in 75 or so, was it July 4th, 75 is when you played your first gig there. Just give us a walk through, if we were going to see you, you know, what was the stage like? You know, you also discussed, like, most of the activity, it smelled so horrible in there that after the band was done, that you wanted to see, everyone went outside and there's all this activity, in the bathrooms that equaled whatever was going on the stage.
Oh, no, it was, you know, I mean, it was a dive, you know. I mean, as I said, it was a biker bar. They had this dog, Hilly, who was, again, he was this old biker guy, you know, burly, bearded, big guy. He had a dog, and basically the dog, you know, shat everywhere. And, and the whole thing was like I said, it was before the punk thing. It was all this kind of, you know, we like dirt, or, you know, we like it rough. It wasn't love and peace. It was all kind of, it wasn't health and well-being. It was all kind of, you know, on the edge kind of thing. And it was a dive. You walked in and there was either Roberta Bailey or a fellow named Merv or somebody else was at the door, and they checked you out. And if you were in the band, you got in free. Or if you were somebody, you got in. If not, you know. And initially it was like being on a deserted island where everybody took in each other's washing, you know, because we, you know, the audience was other band members. You know, so you had other bands come see you play initially, except for the big names in the beginning, like Patti Smith or Television, and then gradually it became more. You walked in the place, they checked you out, and then it was just straight on to your left. You walked in, there was, if I remember correctly, the jukebox and, you know, tables, and, you know, and then on your right was a long bar. And, you know, nothing fancy at all. I mean, the dressing room was nothing. It just was some partition. The toilet was, nobody even used the toilet because it was horrible. They went outside. I guess the women, the punkettas, used the toilet, but I don't know. I mean, lots of guys went outside. And it was like an empty lot nearby. And it was around it, outside CBGB's. It was the Bowery, what the Bowery used to be, which was, you know, Skid Row. So homeless. Well, the homeless people, mostly men, all these different hotels. It's the Palace Hotel next door to, you know, CBGB, which was a flop house, you know, and that was all around there. So it wasn't a particularly, you know, it's a salubrious kind of neighborhood. And then other places nearby, you know, catered to different kinds of, you know, weirdness. There were, you know, gay bars nearby and things of that sort. There was a truck and warehouse theater where my girlfriend at the time, Lisa Jane Persky, who later went on to do quite a few films and also was a photographer and writing a lot for a newspaper called New York Rocker. That's where I stole the title. my book from. She was doing a play with, you know, one of the, you know, classic people from this period, Divine, in this Drucken Warehouse Theater. It was called Woman Behind Bars, where she was raped twice nightly by Divine. And as I say in the book, you know, everybody started going to see this play, and everyone on the scene saw my girlfriend, you know, naked twice, you know, already, by going to see this play. So it was an area with all this kind of, you know, strange transgressive stuff was going on, but it wasn't, you know, it was all kind of down and gritty and, not fancy, which was the thing. It wasn't supposed to be that. That was, you know, it was away from the mainstream kind of thing. And, you know, it had a horrible smell. The beer was cheap and the sound system wasn't the greatest, but it couldn't hold that many people. It wasn't a big place. But in that early period, you got, you know, if you were there as I was, and, you know, that's, I'm very happy that I was there. I had fantastic fond memories from the time. You just got to see up close all these people, you know, basically become who they were. So, you know, like the Ramones and the Talking Heads, and Blondie. And there were bands that didn't get known beyond it. There was a great band called the Miamis. They wrote wonderful songs, very intelligent, satirical, comic songs about current events, and other bands, the Mumps, Lance Loud, you know, who was part of the Warhol kind of circle and all that. They didn't get the record deals and all that kind of thing. But at the scene at the time, they were there. And
okay. And, you know, since you just mentioned Divine, you have a little story in your book about when you first approached him about "Is It True?"
Oh, from Pink Flamingos.
Yes.
Yeah, he said. He Divine is a he. You know, is a transvestite, but, you know, who was made famous or infamous in a series of films by John Waters. One of which, the most famous one, notorious one, is called Pink Flamingos. And at the end of the film, there's a scene where Divine eats dog shit. If I can say that, I don't know. And everyone always asks. we had lunch together a few times with Lisa and other things, and went to some other events. And before we were recording, you mentioned earlier that I talk about doing this video of Medea, mm-hmm. You know, the Greek tragedy of Medea with Divine playing Medea, and Lisa, my girlfriend at the time, myself, we were the children who were going to be executed, and this fellow Benton, who's, you know, who owned, had the lease on the Loft Space, we were living with Chris and Debbie, I forget the character's name, but he plays the kind of the tutor, and it's all method acting. And I remember one point I say in the book where he's dragging us across the floor. We're on our knees. And I say, "Hey, Benton, it hurts." And he says, "It's supposed to hurt. You're about to be executed." So I don't know whatever happened to that. But in these days, it's the sort of thing that, you know, were it available, it would be up on YouTube and getting going viral, I would think. So a lot of stuff from that time is lost because nobody had a video camera, or it wasn't anything like now. That was the thing, and it all crossed over. I mean, we did different things in the early days of Blondie. We did the music to a production of a play by a Warhol, play the Warhol circle, Jackie Curtis, called Vain Victory, if you can call it a play. It's just an endless kind of, you know, camp gay jokes, you know. It was an introduction. It was put on by people that were part of that world. And that world was still, you know, influential at the time, and people that were involved with that were involved with Bowie and a variety of other things. And so there were all that kind of thing. And then the art scene too. So, I mean, it was a time when a lot of these things were just crossing over. So you would go to somebody's loft to some art event, and then, you know, people that were, you knew from CBGB were there as well, or these art people would be going to the club, or you go to some poetry event or some film, you know, kind of thing. And then, you know, and then after a while, Max's Kansas City started happening. Max is big in the late 60s and in the early 70s, and at some Warhol held court there. And, you know, lots of people played there. Iggy played there, and, you know, Alice Cooper, I think, and, you know, lots of other people. And it was a famous place to hang out and seen and be seen. That was more upmarket originally. You know, that was more rock stars hanging out, which CBGB wasn't. And then it closed for a while, and then it reopened and reinvented itself as another, you know. It was called New York Rock or Street Rock. It wasn't called punk. Punk Magazine turned up, and then it kind of got this name. And it started to shift then, because it became too easily recognizable. You could come over from, you know, you can come over from Connecticut and, you know, be a punk or something on the weekend. So, and it started to lose that edge, kind of art, poetry, kind of leavening that the three chord rock was getting. That to me made it very, very interesting and pretty much unlike any other time, I think.
And Gary, when, you know, you're on stage at CBGB, you know, in these early days of Blondie, you know, you're doing some covers, but you also have a disco song that's going to be, you know, a worldwide hit as Heart of Glass. You know, you are writing some songs on your own. You've written, or you know, you're going to write some songs with Debbie. What are some of the other songs that you contributed to the early days of Blondie?
Well, I mean, I wrote a lot of songs, the ones that got recorded. Ex-Offender, I mean, I wrote that, and then Debbie, I mean, yeah, I wrote the music and all that, and then the lyrics to the chorus, and Debbie wrote the lyrics to the verse, and then a song we did called Kung Fu Girls, I wrote a bit of that, and Jimmy Destri contributed something, and Debbie, you know, the lyrics. But even some songs that didn't get recorded, I wrote at the time, because we were just experimenting, you know. And that was the thing. That was the thing that I felt like, wow, you can do this. I don't have to be a great guitarist like all these guys I knew when I was growing up. I used to put on the headphones and diligently work away at learning how to do the guitar solo that, you know, like Clapton does there, or Hendrix did there, or whatever Steve Howe from Yes did there, that was, you know, completely beyond me. There was no way I could ever do that. But I could learn how to put a few chords together, and, you know, suddenly I could, you know, as I said, turn bad poetry into you know, halfway decent songs. And so I wrote quite a few songs around at the time. They didn't get, you know, recorded. There's some live recordings up on YouTube. There's a weird song called Star Beast. I mean, I wrote the music too, and then this friend who was part of this gang of weirdos and fringe people that I mentioned earlier, that I knew from New Jersey, he wrote the lyrics, and his name was Ronnie Toast. That was his sort of nom de plume, but he co-wrote a couple Blondie songs. There's one called Cautious Lip, I think, that's on their second album, Plastic Letters. One called Rifle Range, it's on their first album. He wrote this weird stream of unconsciousness kind of poetry that somehow fit in at the time. And so, the big song, well, Ex-Offenders got us the record deal. And then later I wrote a song called I'm Always Touched by Your Presence, Dear, about Lisa. And it was about all these telepathic experiences we were having, these psychic experiences. So at the time that I had got interested in all this kind of stuff because of living in this loft space and being introduced to it by this fellow Benton, and also discovering this book called The Occult by Colin Wilson, which changed my life, as one dramatically says. And I became very, very interested in all that sort of thing, the paranormal, the mystical, the magical, the esoteric, and so on. And eventually, you know, my early youthful enthusiastic indiscriminate embrace of it, you know, became, you know, more or less serious study of it. And But at the time, I was just, you know, plunging into it. And we started having these strange, when I was, we were on, because the Blondie's breakthrough, we recorded the album in late 76. It came out at the very end of 76, but in 77, we sort of spring or late winter or whatever, 77, we went on this tour, U.S. tour, North American tour, opening for Iggy Pop, of Iggy and the Stooges, and he's one of the grandfathers or whatever, fathers of punk rock. And on that tour, David Bowie was in Iggy's band, although he was not announced. He was performing and traveling incognito. In fact, he drove, and if you know The Man Who Fell to Earth, that film, the car and the chauffeur in the film is Bowie's car. And he wouldn't fly, so he drove to all the different gigs. And, you know, we did, it was a long tour, and there's a whole account of the tour in the book. And, but we got to know Iggy, and then that later on, after I left Blondie, and, well, the last person I played with, and, at least at that time was in 1981, I did two tours with Iggy Pop, and Clem was drumming with him at that time too. So that was like the other end of the story. Yeah, I mean, you know, we recorded the album, and it came out in beginning of late. It came out at the end, like Christmas time. In fact, I remember there was a review in the New York Times on my birthday, which was Christmas Eve. So I thought that was quite that augured well for the future.
Gary, aside from all the, you know, stories of well-known musicians, you know, you do appropriately credit those who helped to get you to where you are. You know, for example, you wrote very fondly of Alan Bettrock, as well as Frankie Valli, Chuck Barris, helped, I guess, but you know, you're also fair with your recreations of, you know, the Bad Business Deals, the underbelly of the music scene, like Nancy and her influence in England, while, you know, she was shagging Sid. You really, this book really does take a comprehensive view of about a four-year time period.
1974, 1981. So it's about seven years.
Seven years.
And then there's a tag end when I was briefly part of the Blondie, the Recidivists, the reunion in the late 90s for a brief time. But I mean, the main story is 74 to 81. Yeah. I retired after 81.
You also have, I don't know, couple pages or so devoted to your the day-long meeting with your hero Ian Hunter. He was a really big name at that time. Can you tell us a little bit about, you know, the exhilaration of meeting a hero?
Well, I mean, that was when I was living with Chris and Debbie, and it was New Year's Day, 76, and we were invited to Ian Hunter's house, which is somewhere in upstate New York, and we were invited by Lee Black Childers, who was, again, part of the Warhol circle and a photographer and part of the Bowie kind of entourage and so on. And, well, you know, Well, one wonders if Lee invited us because Debbie had her car, her Camaro, and we could drive there. But I'm not going to get catty about that sort of thing. That's the kind of thing you would argue about with Lee. He said, "Oh, Lee, you've only invited me because of my car." "Oh no, not at all." But any case, Ian Hunter is not as well known probably these days, and at the time he never quite got as big as he should have been. But he was in a band called Mott the Hoople, and he wrote these really interesting songs, you know, interesting lyrics, and it was very good music. And they had a couple hits. Well, the big hit, at least I think in the States, was All the Young Dudes, but that was Bowie had wrote that. But they had, you know, bigger hits in the UK. And he wrote A Diary of a Rock Star, which I liked too, because it was, I don't know. And I sadly modeled myself after him. And for some reason, he wore dark glasses all the time. So I started doing that. I think it ruined my eyes because I wore dark glasses at night often. But I have to say, when we were invited to go on New Year's Day, to spend New Year's Day at his place, I wondered, God, you know, does he wear the dark glasses at home? And I discovered, yes, indeed, he did. But we all, you know, we hung out. We had, you know, Christmas Day, whatever, food, dinner, drinks, and all that. And then we wound up jamming, which was it was just a lot of fun. I mean, I'm thinking, like, what the hell? You know, not too long ago, I was in New Jersey wondering what I'm going to do with myself or whatever. How am I ever going to escape this, one-horse town, as it were? And here I am, you know, I'm hanging with one of my heroes. And, you know, for a while, that was happening in my life. I mean, we did this tour with Iggy. I later played with Iggy. I met Bowie more than a few times. I even got kicked out of Bowie's loft space in Midtown Manhattan in the early 80s, yeah, around this time, 81 or something like that. And this is precisely because of an argument about Colin Wilson, who I mentioned earlier. His book, The Occult, got me interested in all this sort of thing. And I went with a friend of mine, was invited to some get together at Bowie's loft space, and he, you know, he said, "Come on along," and I said, "Why not? You know, whatever." And you know, not that I was any kind of, you know, close friend or anything like that, anything at all, but you know, we did our paths had crossed, as it were, or my path had crossed his larger orbit once or twice. And but in any case, in a lull in the conversation, someone, and the conversation had been about the occult or the supernatural, and my friend said, you know, I guess to get things going or to get an entree, he said, "Oh, well, you know, Gary knows all about this because he reads Colin Wilson." And Bowie said, "Colin Wilson, oh, he heads a coven in Cornwall. And, you know, he draws pentagrams on people's doors and all this kind of stuff." And that really wasn't the case. And Bowie was a bit inspired at the time, if you nudge, nudge, wink, wink, know what I mean. And myself, being a very kind of straightforward and, you know, honest guy, I said, "Well, David, it's not really like that." "Oh, no, he does. And he draws down those spirits of, you know, Nazis and all this weird stuff," he was saying. And so long story short, that he had these two women bodyguards. And I forget which James Bond film it is, where there's Thumper and Bambi, but they're like these two, you know, women assassins, you know, who, you know, try to, mm-hmm. you know, do Bond in. So it was sort of like Thumper and Bambi came over to me, and they said, "David's a bit tired, perhaps you should leave." I said, "Okay, I'll go." So, you know, I got kicked out, but I later realized, you know, what he was doing. And long story short, I know which book of Wilson's he was reading at the time, and he was conflating different things that Wilson was writing about. But he was under the influence of a inspirational substance, so I'll cut him some slack.
How did all this early on writing when you're 19, 20 prepare you for writing these historical books that Barbara interviews you about?
Well, I started reading about all this stuff then. That's basically it. And the more I read, the more interested I became. And I mean, one of the things I say in the book is gradually, one reason I left music is I was getting too smart for rock and roll. My own band I had after Blondie. I left Blondie in late 77 and wound up moving to Los Angeles because Lisa and I were still together, and she had gone there to pursue her acting career. And I got more into all of this sort of stuff there. I started a band called The Know, K-N-O-W, and that was because of my interest in Gnosticism, which is about gnosis, which is knowledge. And I got deeper interested in Crowley. I got involved with the Crowley group for a while. And then, gradually I just started reading more of this sort of thing, and certainly more and more of Colin Wilson. I became, you know, rather addicted to his books. And whenever we were on tour, even with Blondie, I would always get up early, and if there were any like used bookshops in town, go to them and buy everything and all this kind of stuff. And then I would do the same, you know, with The Know. I mean, even though we didn't get a big record deal, we were a very popular band on the East and West Coast. We were a bi-coastal band, and we used to do mini tours up either coast. You put out a couple singles and so on. And so gradually I just, you know, and then when The Know didn't get their own record deal, I kind of said, okay, I've done this. The taste of music was sort of changing, and I didn't feel inspired anymore to sort of write songs for, that's one of the reasons too. And then, a friend of mine, Rob Dupre, who was a guitarist, he was in this band called The Mumps, one of the bands I mentioned that were around CB's day, but you know, didn't get the acclaim that later bands did. He was playing with Iggy, and Ivan Kral, who had played with Blondie for a while and played with Patti Smith for a while, he was playing with Iggy, but he jumped ship just before a tour. And Rob said, you know, do you want to come on tour? And I said, sure. I said, fine, you know. Who doesn't want to play with Iggy? So I knew most of the songs already, and you know, the older ones, and then I learned the others on the tour bus. So for a year I was just a hired gun. It was kind of like the Wild Bunch, you know, the Peckinpah film. It's like the Wild Bunch rock tour. It was kind of make or break tour with Iggy, with his record label at the time, Arista, I believe. And it was an album called Party. So that's what that tour was about. I was like, yeah, party. So we did. And after that tour, I kind of said, okay, I've done it. And I didn't really want to play anymore. I kind of outgrew it at that point. And that I went completely different direction. I spent a couple of years not doing anything particular. I had President's Dear was a big hit in Europe and the UK, and it was top 10. So I got, you know, a nice chunk of royalties from that. And I just read a lot. I went on a kind of mini search for the miraculous in the early 80s, 83, to places like Glastonbury and Shorts Cathedral and Stonehenge. And then I also tracked down the Prairie in Fontainebleau, where Gurdjieff had his Institute for the Harmonious Development of Man, because I was very interested in the Gurdjieff work at the time. And then that's when I also made my pilgrimage to Cornwall to meet Colin Wilson, where he lived. And I started the correspondence, and then later, you know, a friendship, you know, over the years. He died 30 years later in 2013, and so on. But over those years, we stayed in touch and met many times, and you know, even stayed with me a couple once in Los Angeles when I was living there in the early 90s. My life went in that direction, and went through many, many changes. And here I am now, living in England for 25 years, having written quite a few books about all this stuff. And I'm not, you know, I'm not really in the music. I mean, briefly, I think I said earlier, I mean, Blondie, they started this kind of reunion in the late 90s, and I got involved with that for a while, and I did quite a few concerts with them, and even did some recording with them, one of my songs, which kind of got lost in the mix. I don't know, maybe it'll turn up one day. And then after that, when I got kicked out of Blondie again, twice with 20 years in between, there's a story about that. But I had a band here for a while called Fire Escape. And we did, you know, for about 2 years, we played lots of gigs in London and all that. And, then, you know, I had children, the writing had started. And so that's what I needed to do.
Okay. Gary, you...
Can we take a break for a sec?
Sure.
1 sec. I'll be right back.
Okay. Yeah, this has been a fascinating recreation of history.
It certainly presents a whole nother side of this amazing man.
Yeah.
I'm sitting here giggling. You know, I've talked to him about John the Baptist and about all sorts of, you know, heavy-duty esoteric subjects and, you know, Crowley. And to find out that he had this side of him, in a way makes him more approachable and in another way makes him less approachable.
It's definitely New York Rocker is definitely a captivating book.
Well, yeah, and you know, you hear about this side of music, but you know, he's flipping out, you know, things like Warhol and all of these. I mean, I actually recognize mm-hmm. some of these names. Some of the music you get into, I have no idea who you're talking about, but I am of a generation that recognizes just about every name he's thrown out there, which is kind of, I'm sitting here giggling, thinking, oh my God, I recognize those names. And of course, he was in New York, and I lived in New York, and, you know, so that you know, not that I can speak with any great amount of wisdom about all of this, but okay. I remember the songs and the places.
Mm-hmm. Oh, okay, Gary.
All right, I'm back. Thank you.
Gary's back. If people are interested in seeing some of these early days of Blondie, you know, they can go to YouTube, see a whole bunch of stuff. The Don Kirchner is on YouTube,
yeah.
And there's like a little backstory there where you and Chris traded instruments and. He wasn't too happy
yeah.
about that.
Well, that was another reason, one of the reasons why I had to go. I mean, one reason I had to go, if you ever see that early video of X Offender, not only am I playing a guitar, but I'm jumping around madly, which is what, you know, we weren't rock stars. We were kids playing rock. In any case, you know, but the other thing is, yeah, I played guitar because it was my song, X Offender, and I wanted to play guitar on it. And, you know, Chris is, his style, I mean, he was good what he did and all that, and you know, all that, but I didn't think his style was good for the song and that kind of thing. And that was one of the bones of contention or the things that started friction, was that I wanted to play guitar on more of the songs that I was writing. And I mean, it's understandable in hindsight that you know, would have caused problems, but at the time I was young and, you know, full of myself, and now I'm just old and full of myself. So, it's fine.
But when you are living with Chris and Debbie, or just in the band, you're 19. They're basically 10 years older.
Well, Debbie,
you know,
Debbie
they're approaching
was 10 years,
30.
Debbie was 10 years older. Still is. She still is 10 years mm-hmm. older than me. And Chris, I think, was about five or six. So, I mean, but I was the youngest. I was a kid. I mean, literally. The other guys were a year older than me, at least. So yeah. Yeah, I mean, she had been around for a while already. You know, she had a band in the late 60s called The Wind in the Willows, and then various different incarnations of groups before it turned into Blondie. I said the first time I saw her was the group she called the Stilettos, and then it was three. It was like a girl group, like the Supremes or something like that. Mm-hmm. You know, and it was all kind of campy kind of stuff. And then, I don't know, something Blondie and the Bonsai Babies and Angel and Snake and, you know, so different incarnations trying to make it, you know, on the scene. And it's, you know, it started to gel into something when Clam started playing, and then I started playing, and then when we got Jimmy, then it developed this kind of recognizable sound that was, you know, Blondie. At least then, it was kind of a 60s retro sound, because Jimmy had this Farfisa organ. And I grew up, you know, I heard all this great music on the radio when I was a kid in the 60s. I mean, I was born at the end of 55, so I remember going to school in the early 60s, and even before the Beatles, it was, you know, all the girl groups kind of thing, you know, the Shirelles and all that, and then Ronettes, and then there was the British Invasion, and then you'd have, then the American groups start, you know, Love and Spoonful, the Birds, and all that. So I just grew up with all this kind of very melodic songs, you know, on the radio, and that's more or less what came out later on when I started writing songs. But then, you know, the taste changed, and so it was sort of like, oh well, you know, that's kind of what I did. So it wasn't really what, you know, what was happening after a certain point.
And Gary, you have a lot of photos in your book, probably never before published photo. You just have a book that has these photos that depict the graffiti all over the walls and the, you know, just recreate the scene. Plus, you know, you know, your stories of being there. It's really a fantastic book that, you know, does fit in with what we do on Nightlight. Is, you know, it's kind of focus on transporting people to different time periods, and, you know, let's, you know, like I said at the beginning of the show, you know, the researchers discuss it. Well, you know, you were actually there, but I think New York Rockers, if you like that time period, or, you know, just a listener is looking for something to read, it's a neat autobiography of all these big name people that became your friends.
Well, yeah, I mean, I wouldn't want to say everybody's in there. I tried to jam as many names as I could on the cover to get people's attention. But yeah, I mean, it's all the, you know, I mean, it was my life. It's what the subtitle is, My Life in the Blank Generation. And the Blank Generation was a song by Richard Hell. And that was kind of the anthem, as it were, of that period in New York then. And blank meant sort of, you can fill in the blank. So it was about reinventing yourself. And that's what, you know, people were doing then. And I was, you know, what can I say, is absolutely thrilled to have been part of it, and, you know, and still be around. One of the sad things is that a lot of people from that time aren't around anymore. I haven't looked up the statistics, but I wonder what, you know, how the mortality rate from that generation compares to, you know, earlier and later ones. Because many of the people I knew from that time just passed away for a variety of reasons. And it's a New York that doesn't exist anymore. You talk about lost worlds, you know, it just isn't there anymore. I mean, New York itself has changed dramatically over the years. The parts of town where this took place aren't the same. And yeah, and the thing, you know, among other things, is that nobody can afford to live in New York anymore. You know, one of this music scene took place where it did because that part of New York at that time was still relatively affordable for people that were artists or musicians. You know, so, but now you can't. I mean, that's what always happens. The pioneers go and stake out the area, and then gradually, this is a part of town that's becoming popular and hip, and then landlords start hiking up the rent and push everybody out. So I don't even know where it was. Brooklyn for a while, but I think Brooklyn's even out of reach of lots of people now too. So, but at that time, this was, and again, you have to remember, this is New York 75. This is the garbage strike. 77 was Son of Sam. So,
mm-hmm.
It was
the blackout.
The blackout. Yep, it was a strange time. It was a strange time in New York. I mean, I'm nothing but happy that I was able to be there at that time and to live in these interesting neighborhoods. Like I lived in the East Village, the Bowery. I lived in the West Village, Little Italy. Got to know New York, and during the formative years of my late teens and early 20s. So what can I say? Well, thanks a lot for going through these, little trip down memory lane here.
Yeah, I know, Gary, you have, a lot of important things that you need to get to, and I just wanted to let you know, I appreciate you making the suggestion of get my New York rocker and. coming back to recreate this interesting time period. I'm very appreciative of this opportunity and the suggestion you made. I this was really a terrific show. It was a lot of fun, and I know you have to. Get back to business. I just wanted to thank.
Well, thank you. It's a pleasure. I mean, if your listeners want to get a sense of it, listen to the first albums everybody made. So the first Patti Smith, first Television, first Ramones, first Talking Heads, the first Blondie album, and it'll give you a sense of what it was like.
Okay, and of course,
buy my book too.
Yeah. Oh yeah, so several of your books, and where do you want to send people to get?
It's on Amazon.
Inner Traditions.
My other stuff. The books I've been writing. I mean, that's just you can get them on Amazon or anything. I have a website. I don't know much about this kind of thing, but as you mentioned, there's some early clips of Blondie on YouTube. There's some very, very early stuff, some very early black and white stuff. From the very earliest days I was playing with them. So from archival perspective, it's very interesting. And there's other stuff too. I think there's even bits of some clips of when I was playing with them again when I started playing with them again in 96, late 96, for about a year, the first thing we did was Chris, Debbie, and I played at this tribute to William Burroughs in Lawrence, Kansas. I mean, Burroughs was still alive at the time. And other people on the bill were like Patti Smith, Philip Glass, Laurie Anderson, kind of the New York hip crowd. So, I mean, after being out of it for a long time, and this was all during this period when I just moved to London. I'd already did this tour of Easter. I was covering an arts festival in Boston. Strange stuff was happening. And then I got a call to come, asking me if he wanted to come back to New York and put the band back together. So what the hell? So I went, and then one of the first things we did was go and do this show, and there's some clips of that up on YouTube too. So, there's some stuff out there. There's some evidence of all this stuff out with the general cultural debris out there. So you can, if you really want to find it, you can.
Okay. And I've just been, I was really impressed with how accurate your memory was on the dates, people who were the headliners they were opening for you. It's really, you do demonstrate a thorough recollection of to some of these shows and festivals.
Mm. I kept journals at the time, and all that sort of thing. And I wanted to write the whole time I was doing all this, but it took me quite some time to be able to learn how to write something that people would find readable. I mean, I had at least a good 10 years between leaving music and starting to, write through magazines and journals in the early 90s. Yeah, but it's a different thing, for me, it's a personal transformation, as it were, from going, from being, you might want to say more right brain artistic kind of character to, 10 years later, kind of focusing on a more, left brain, but very different, kind of approach to things. And the songwriting just came to me at the time, whereas I had to learn how to write, readable prose.
Okay. So, what is next?
I don't know. Some sort of mid-books at the moment. I have a book supposed to come out next year, but because of COVID, it's been pushed back a year.
Mm-hmm.
And it's called Time and the Dreaming Mind, and it's about my experiences with precognitive dreams and synchronicities, those odd, meaningful coincidences that happen to us more often than we probably know. So that's it's supposed to come out next year, but with any luck, it'll be out early 2022.
Okay. You are welcome to return to cover.
Yeah, I'll let you know. Yeah,
please do.
When that's happening, I'll be posting about it and all that. So.
Okay, and there's a Blondie box set in the works.
It's one of these big, collections of everything. So they asked me for some, memories and so on and so on. So there's I contributed something to liner notes and so on. And it's a big, I'm a little part of that. A few recordings of me in there, but it's their whole career. So that's coming out. I don't know exactly when, but relatively soon, I think, because they keep telling me it's on its way.
Okay. So people can look for...
Yeah, watch out for that.
Yeah, the Blondie box set. Okay. Gary, I know you want to do just about an hour, and we've gone a little bit over.
Yeah, there you go.
I just don't want to hold you up anymore. Is there anything else you want to cover?
Oh, no, it's fine. I actually need to have dinner.
Yeah, so that's
right.
I know.
But this has been great. It's fun. It's been fun talking about all this stuff. I don't talk about it that often, so it's it was fun.
I am very appreciative, and Barbara's had a good time with the show too. And let's just wrap it up. And I'm sure you're going to be back sometime soon. And I just want to thank you and recommend for the listeners to get Gary Valentine's New York Rocker. It's a terrific autobiography.
Thank you very much.
All right. Take care, Gary.
You too. Take care, Mark.
Thank you. Bye.
Take care. Bye-bye now.